If we lose our language, we lose so much knowledge and wisdom. We lose what we are, what we are made of, what our wisdom teaches us, and all of Zapotec history.
Coming up on In Contrast, Preserving a Language and Identity with Karen Werner, Wendy Cole, and the poetry of Zapotec poet Irma Pineda. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.
Kisu uyuna agatte. Kisu uyuna agatte. Kisa anda kusia anduna. Na anga nyo bishose lu. Dija yo osho bishose gola lu. Girani ma bisia akaji kali. Nisaru una tigesa mastalle jibi bani. Tinaya ganismana bana binittila de bandaga. Kisu uyuna agatte.
You will not see me die. You won't forget me. I am your mother, your father, your grandfather's old stories, age-old traditions. The tear welling from an old willow, the saddest branch lost among the leaves. You will not see me die.
That's a segment of You Will Not See Me Die, a radio documentary by Karen Werner about the Zapotec poet Irma Pineda. Karen Werner and Pineda's translator, Wendy Cole, are my guests. Karen Werner is a radio producer and sociologist interested in the transformation and connection between the political and the personal. Her work has been broadcast in Austria, Australia, Israel, Ireland, Scotland, and the United States. Wendy Cole is a writer, translator, and educator. Her book, No Words for Welcome, explores how economic globalization intersects with village life in southern Mexico. She co-edited Telling True Stories, a nonfiction writer's guide from the Nieman Foundation at Harvard University. Cole is also a translator of the poetry of Zapotec poet Irma Pineda and is on the faculty of Pacific Lutheran University. Istmus Zapotec is one of the indigenous languages of Latin America. It is spoken in the southern part of Mexico, and it has roughly 100,000 speakers. It is one of the endangered languages in the world, and Irma Pineda is a poet devoted to keeping that language alive and making sure that its speakers have a continuity between past, present, and future. Wendy, why don't you tell me who Irma Pineda is? I'd love to hear her role in the context of her culture, the relationship that she has to her readers, to her listeners, and to Zapotec as a civilization.
Sure. Irma Pineda is a poet from the city of Juchitán, which is in the state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico. She is Istmus Zapotec, and she produces most of her poetic work in both her home language, Istmus Zapotec, and also in Spanish. So she is a bilingual poet. She's published 7 collections of poetry. She has a new collection coming out in just a few months. And she also works as a professor of intercultural education at the National Teachers University in the city of Ixtepec, which is close to her home in Juchitán.
What does it mean to translate a poet like Irma? Irma writes in 2 languages. She writes originally in Zapotec, and then, as she puts it, she makes versions that are in Spanish, parallel poems in Spanish. Tell me about the process.
The process is a really long one. And I have to say that at first I felt a lot of trepidation about translating a poem that was originally conceived of in a language that I did not know. So I was asked by a mutual friend of Irma Pineda's and mine to attempt these translations for an event that was happening here in Seattle at which we wanted to feature indigenous Latin American languages. And I had a lot of trepidation about it, and I did the poems and thought that would sort of be it. And then I started a correspondence with Irma, and I realized that by working with her directly, she could sort of be a co-translator in terms of bringing these poems into English. Not that she speaks much English or reads, she reads some English, not a ton, that she could really explain to me the process that she went through between taking the poem from Isma Zapotec into Spanish, and then also some things that she wasn't able to bring across that canyon between the two languages. And then when I was recreating the poem in English, I could work from the Spanish version primarily, but I could also sometimes bring items that had been left behind in the Zapotec into the English. And so the process is that I create a draft translation from the Spanish, sometimes with the Zapotec dictionary, looking through the Zapotec version, although there aren't really good Zapotec dictionaries. And then I go and meet with her in person, and we go through the poem. I also listen to her recordings of the Zapotec version, because she usually records all of her poetry when it's published. And then I go away and I revise the translation based on this conversation I've had with her. And then usually we meet again in person before I actually finalize it and put it out into the world.
There is a striking parallel, maybe an asymmetry, in what you are describing. You don't know Zapotec. There is a bridge language that is Spanish. Through that language, the original poem is arriving to you. And Irma Pineda, the original Istmo Zapotec poet, doesn't know English or knows very little English. And so the arrival language is one that she is unfamiliar with. Both of you are in a language that the other one doesn't have, and have a middle language, Spanish in this case, that enables you to come in. It makes me think, Wendy, of certain poets that have translated other poets, Joseph Brodsky from Russia, or a Richard Wilbur here from the United States, who actually translated works from languages they didn't know. Brodsky did not know Spanish and translated from the Spanish into Russian or into English. And Wilbur did not know Portuguese or Spanish and translated both languages into English. I wonder what adjectives you would use to describe the Istmus Zapotec that Irma uses when you hear it in your ears.
When Irma speaks it, and she has a very lovely voice, I mean, part of her work actually is doing narration for film and radio, so she has a really practiced and polished voice. When I hear her perform Zapotec and also Zapotec poems, and also when I just hear her in her day-to-day life talking with the people around her, it really has a music to it and a richness to it. It's a tonal language, so you can hear those tones moving up and down, even though to me the tones don't carry meaning in the way that they would if I understood Zapotec. But you really can hear and feel the layers of emotion in the language. One of the things that Irma talks about is that you can't translate the term "I love you with all my heart" into Zapotec, because in Zapotec you can love people with different parts of your body. You can say, "I love you with my mind," "I love you with all of my guts," "I love you with my heart," "I love you with my liver." And each of those terms means something different. It's a different kind of love. And that's something that she says we can't really convey in Spanish, and I certainly can't imagine how to convey it in English. One of the things that I think a lot about when I hear Zapotec is how it is a language of the body in a way that English strikes me as more a language of the mind.
Lovely. Karen, I want to bring you in. You're a radio producer and a sociologist, but you also do something that has come to be known as performance ethnography or autoethnography, depending on the subject or the quest that you're involved in. And radio is your medium. Radio is your platform. Radio is an extraordinary form in that, as far as I'm concerned, it makes us think in ways that other forms do not. And it is also a form that involves, though few people think about this consciously, involves translation. I wonder if you can reflect a bit on your role as a radio producer and the act and art of translation.
Yeah, it's a great question. So a lot of the pieces on radio that I've done have actually been personal stories. Translating the life of another person is kind of a big responsibility, which is something that we did in this piece, the documentary, You Will Not See Me Die. And I think there are two things going on. Like, one, in the act of really wanting to honor the intention, serve the vision and creativity and politics of Irma Pineda and also Tonio MC Lopez, who is featured in our documentary, a rapper and hip-hop artist. So as much as possible, stepping aside from our own agendas and being a vehicle for what we think they want to offer and express. And at the same time, maybe even intention, having our own intentions for the piece and why we've chosen to tell this story and spent, you know, a lot of time traveling there and producing this piece and thinking how we'll craft this story, what we leave in, what we leave out, so many details. There's a real energy behind what we're doing. And really big part of my love of radio is thinking about the power of the word and that is unleashed through the sounds on the radio that are being broadcast, and broadcast as a metaphor and a literal experience of the vibration of sound and language into the world and the profound creative power of that. On the one hand, there's kind of an intention and a poetics and a politics behind what draws me to this medium, and then at the same time, trying to do justice to the world of the people that we're portraying in this piece.
How do you do that? How do you choose your subject? When do you feel that a piece is acquiring its shape, that it's taking its form, that it is properly edited? Maybe the same question that I was asking Wendy. When is the radio producer as ethnographer failing? And when is that radio producer achieving what the hidden or visible goals are?
I think one way of answering your question is to think of a really interesting tension in this piece, You Will Not See Me Die, because the main voices in the piece, Irma Pineda and Tonio MC, are optimistic about the survival of this indigenous language. And at the same time, we have certain things to reconcile with. For instance, the rapper Tonio MC does not speak Zapotec, and he represents this generation of 20-year-olds who are the coming generation, who are very drawn to Zapotec and yet don't speak it. So there's this real tension. How do we ride that line of optimism and using the power of word to energize a reality that Wendy and I would really like to energize, the flourishing of this indigenous language and culture, at the same time stay connected to nuances and realities? So I think that's kind of the interesting line around poetics and politics of radio storytelling, and really being aware of our intentions while also being an accurate translator of reality.
Wendy, there is, in translating a poem like You Will Not See Me Die or other poems by Irma, the hope in a translator that though the listener in the language to which this is being translated, in your case English, will not be necessarily exposed to Istmo Zapotec, that something will linger in the ears, that you will get a taste through that veil that is translation of the original. There is also an element here that is fascinating, fascinatingly complex, and maybe could be described as handcuffing the poet and the translator. And that is that for someone like Irma Pineda, writing poetry is not only about what she's going to be talking about in a particular poem, but the fact that she's talking about it in this language. The act of writing in that language is a form of survival. And being able to convey those sounds that Karen was talking about in radio, in her case, in poetry, is very powerful. Listen, my audience. It seems to me that Irma is saying, listen to how these words sound, not only about what these words mean. Do you think that in that sense, a poet that is so committed to the survival of a language has a lesser range of topics than one whose language is a standard one, who doesn't have to fight for the survival and who doesn't have to really worry so much about how the words sound, can focus on content more?
That's a really good set of questions. In terms of the use of Zapotec as a poetic vehicle, it is Irma's home native language of her heart, as she calls it. She says that most of the poems that come into her being, come into her mind, come in Zapotec, but not always. And she does have a full collection of poetry that she wrote quite a number of years ago that is only in Spanish. And that is mostly inspired by literature that she read in Spanish or translated into Spanish from mostly other European languages. And she tried for many years to get this collection published. And this year she'll publish her 7th collection of bilingual Zapotec Spanish poetry. And publishers were telling her, well, you're a Zapotec poet. We really want your poems to be bilingual. And she tried and failed several times to translate this collection of Spanish poems into Zapotec. And she realized these poems were born in Spanish. They have nothing to do with my Zapotec self. And she finally decided, actually, just this month to publish that collection of Spanish-only poems on Amazon Crossing, which would accept her as a Spanish-speaking only poet. And so there is really this tension, I think, more in terms of how the world in Mexico sees her as an indigenous poet, therefore she should create these things in Zapotec and in Spanish, rather than just being able to be seen as a poet who creates in whichever of her native languages occur to her.
Wendy, I want to stay with you for just a second. What is the purpose of a translation? I know it sounds like an easy and even simple-minded question, but when does a translator and or a translation fail? When does it not work in spite of the talent of the original poet or the translator? And when does it succeed?
In terms of conveying all of the genius and art and wonder of the original work in another language, I guess I would have to fall on the side of it always fails, because we can't ever do that perfectly, of course, as you know, as a translator. I think in terms of when I feel like a translation that I've created, if not having succeeded, at least I've gone far enough with it, is when whatever emotion I felt when I read the poem in Spanish, the language that I understand, when I share my English translation with someone and ask them how they feel, they convey the same thing. And sometimes that means creating a translation that isn't as quote-unquote faithful as my earlier version is, because when I ask someone to read it and ask them how they feel, they don't name the right emotion. So that's usually the measure that I use for when I personally think I've gotten to some level of success, if not full success.
Do you think one translates as a man or one translates as a woman? Do you think it's important that you are a woman and that the poet that you're translating is a woman? Do we sometimes overstress or overemphasize gender? What are your thoughts?
I think that's a really good question. I will say I don't do a lot of translation. It's a fairly small part of my work. But I did decide a number of years ago that I was only going to translate women, not because I'm a woman and I think that I can relate to their poetry better necessarily, but because when I started looking at the statistics of what a small portion of world literature is translated into English for a U.S. audience, and of that small portion, what a small portion was women authors, I decided that with my tiny little bit of translation energy, that's where I would focus. In terms of Irma's poems, she writes a lot about being a mother. She writes a lot about childbirth. She has a whole collection of poems about childbirth. But as a woman who has never had a child, I don't necessarily think I would be able to relate to those poems and translate them better than a man. One thing that I have found interesting is that she does have quite a huge club of fans. They do seem to be sort of equally male and female. And then also in terms of getting her poems published in the U.S. in literary journals, when I think about it, I think most of the editors I've worked with who have been very excited about Irma's poetry have been men. I think it's been a slight majority men. It seems to me that the empirical evidence is that her poetry does not appeal more to women, even though she writes a lot about living life in a female body.
Karen, do you think one does radio differently in terms of gender?
You know, there's so many factors in why we do radio, and you know, I think it's definitely a big part of it for me, the power of the voice. And I definitely see radio as a social change force because of the power of the word and who we hear. So I also tend to privilege stories that are about women and have women's voices, and love having women broadcast. And again, the voice as a literal and a metaphorical, women's voices, women's experiences, I guess.
I want to talk about the loss of language. It's obviously part of the poem, You Will Not See Me Die, and about vulnerable and endangered languages. But Karen, before I do that, I want to ask you a little more about radio, the radio that you do, imagining it also in terms of loss. I was reading not too long ago that when television came about, people thought that cinema was on the road to disappearing because television was bringing cinema to the living room and taking over. And when cinema came out before that, people said theater is gone. Why would people want to see a play if now they can see it projected in many cities, in multiple cinemas? And yet radio is here and is probably as important as ever. It is an essential ingredient in democracy. Can you imagine a world without radio?
It would just be such a sad world. I love radio. I mean, radio is like this underdog, you know, given all these technologies that you've mentioned that have kind of superseded it. And then lo and behold, look how it's having this fantastic revival around radio storytelling, audio storytelling, podcasts. Podcast is a slightly different space, but definitely connected to radio, kind of a cousin. But radio, community radios all over the world. Radio is a really interesting art form. I've been spending time in Austria lately doing a radio project, and there's a 30-year-old radio show there called Kunstradio, only devoted to the art of radio, people playing with transmission. Transmission and reception as really rich metaphors about what communication is, what the gaps are. And that's actually a wonderful link to the act of translation. The transmission and the reception and the gap, this incredibly rich gap. And there's never going to be a clear line between transmission and reception, just as there's always a gap between people communicating and what whole stories each being is bringing to that communication. So the radio lends itself to that gap that we as translators, literally translators like Wendy, and also maybe radio producer, playing with that gap and being okay with that misunderstanding, celebrating it, being creative with it.
When did you fall in love with radio? Was it a feature in your upbringing? At what point could you say, this is what I'm going to do? I'm going to be an artist of radio or an ethnographer of radio or a producer of radio. When did that marriage come along?
Yeah, it is a marriage. And, you know, it's actually fairly recent for me. I think I fell in love with the form thanks to This American Life. I really was taken with the stories, and the personal stories really have always loved those too. And then, so I think This American Life has really seeded a lot in the U.S. revival of storytelling. So that, you know, goes back 20 years and just listening and getting very drawn into a resource called Third Coast International. It's kind of a web resource and also a festival that happens in Chicago, and fantastic resource for radio documentaries and showcasing an even more international example. So you get to see different cultures and how they do radio documentary, radio storytelling. And I really loved that. So it kind of became a portal into understanding the international styles of storytelling. But I really started to make my own work 5 years ago only, and it's been such an adventure. It's really clicked with my interest in, as a sociologist, in ethnography and documenting. And even, what do we even mean by documenting versus creating stories, and really looking at, again, the poetics and politics of story and language, which is part of why I was so drawn to working with Wendy on You Will Not See Me Die, like just the power of language to create the world and co-create the world.
At the very end of the piece, there's a striking moment, and it's fascinating that you, Karen, chose to keep it at the end and not at the beginning. And that is that one has become, as a listener, familiar with Irma Pineda's voice and with the rapper that has been featured and with what Istmo Zapotec is, the role that it plays in Mexico. And then we hear that the big earthquake in 2017 destroyed an important part of Juchitán. This is the market where many speakers of Istmo Zapotec interact, keep the language alive. That's a major catastrophe. I mean, some of us who have been in Juchitán know how important the marketplace is, the middle ground where people meet. Do you feel, Wendy, that there is an even stronger urgency when a catastrophe of that caliber takes place in what translators do, in what poets do, in what radio producers do? And if so, why didn't the two of you, maybe that would be a question more for Karen, start with the tragedy and go to the beauty of the poem?
That is a really good question. I'm actually really interested to hear what Karen has to say, because she might have a very different idea. Part of it was we were almost done with this piece when the catastrophe happened. I mean, very, very close to done. So there's a logistical reason for it. I would say the more important narrative reason, well, there's a narrative reason and a philosophical reason. The narrative reason would be that the story of Zapotec and the art that comes out of Zapotec lives separately from the endangerment of the language. The language is not interesting because it's endangered. The language is interesting, its art is interesting, and the fact that it's endangered makes that more poignant.
Karen, on that image that comes through at the end of the mentoring piece, that is the collapse of the marketplace in Juchitán.
You know, as Wendy was just referring, like, I remember we were doing like some of the final pieces of bringing the documentary together at that point when that the earthquake hit. And I had been spending that week just listening to our field recordings of the market, which were absolutely the most rich and alive sound recordings of our whole time there. Just the rhythms and the language and the people yelling iguana, iguana, and the sizzling oil and the cacophony and the music. It's the most amazing soundtrack and the incredible poignancy of knowing that that reality was no longer, that we had a record of something that didn't exist, gets back to the point power of radio to hold something in time, kind of play with time and what's alive and what's now past and lost. Just in terms of the issue of the politics of storytelling and how we frame a story, I'm very wary of framing things in terms of a crisis, which that would have been. You got to be very delicate about how you do that. So I think the way that we did that was also intentional. The crisis is not the key. I think it would have taken the wind out of the story if we had put it in a different place.
That's an interesting point, Karen, because radio editors, TV editors, newspaper editors will tell you that what we need is a crisis. We can focus on a particular area of the world. And in fact, if there's no crisis in a particular area of the world, there's no news about it. And you are taking a counterintuitive approach. You are given a crisis, but you are sidelining the crisis because you don't want it to eclipse the actual story that you're delivering.
And it wasn't just for the sake of the story, but again, like, you know, maybe there's even a crisis going on around issues of migration and a lost culture. There's many different experiences going on. So one particular kind of photogenic or media spectacle crisis is one of many things going on, that some of which are less of a spectacle. So I wanted to keep that present.
We have a segment in which Irma Pineda, in the poem, talks about the loss of a language as the loss of a part of your body, fingers and other parts.
Kisu uyuna agate, kizanda gusianduna, na angahio, visho zelu, kijayosho visho zegola lu, girani mavisia akaji kali, nisaru una tigesa mastalle jibibani.
As if we are falling apart, we lose a finger, then a hand, then an arm.
It's a striking image, a finger and a hand and an arm, for the loss of a language. This was Irma Pineda describing loss of a language. And I wonder what a translator would use, what type of metaphors would you use for the loss of some of your tools as a translator that you could not do without?
It's a different thing in that being a Zapotec speaker is fundamental to Irma Pineda's identity and to the identity of every Zapotec speaker. Being a translator is not fundamental to my identity. I mean, I had a fine life before I started translating, and so I think of it as an added richness to my life. Yes, it's a part of my identity, but it's not a part of my identity in a way that being Zapotec is part of Irma's identity. And if I were unable to translate, that would be a sad thing. If Irma Pineda were unable to speak Zapotec, that's a result of cultural genocide. What are the tools I use and what would it mean to lose them? I think of myself as always sort of adding new tools rather than losing them. For example, the relationship that I have with Irma Pineda and the way that I have been able to benefit from the time that she's willing to spend with me explaining very simple things about Zapotec history and culture over and over is a huge benefit to me and really one of the main things that makes it possible for me to do this translation. The fact that I lived in the Isthmus and for several years and wrote a book about it before I ever attempted translating a poem from the region is also really important to me. I can't imagine translating literature from a part of the world that I had not spent a lot of time, much less originally written in a language that I don't speak. So I guess some of my tools are the time that I had there and then the time that I continue to have from the people who create this poetry. Circling back to your original question, without those particular tools, I don't think I'd be able to do this translation at all. It would make it impossible.
It seems to me, Wendy, that the type of work that you do as a translator, but you do other things, you've made that clear, that are integral and maybe even more important to your identity, is that kind of relationship that is in situ, arriving to the place, getting yourself familiarized with the anthropology of exposure, so to speak, and then the dialogue that one has with a poet like Irma Pineda. But there is a trap here, if I could say, also as a translator, and that is that without that exposure, that culture doesn't come about. And there are a number of languages that have already disappeared, that don't have any speakers anymore, that don't have a site where we can go and spend time and try to recreate it. In some ways, this is maybe the difference between translating a dead poet and a living poet. A dead poet, in many ways, you can do whatever you want with that dead poet. It's up to you. Whereas a living poet, there is a kind of responsibility. What do we do, Wendy, as an anthropologist, as a storyteller, and also as a translator, when a language is not in the process of disappearing, but a language has already disappeared?
That is a really good question. I can't imagine trying to do that translation, because I wouldn't be able to speak with anyone who is thinking in that language, who helped create that work. I do have to say, to step back and talk about my own history for a minute, I remember really distinctly the moment that I learned that more than half of the languages on the planet were in danger of extinction. That was about 18 years ago now. I can only think of two other moments in my life where I felt as devastated as I did in that moment. And one was when I was a high school student and learned about nuclear weapons and where we were with the nuclear arms race. And then the other one was in the early 1990s when I started to learn about climate change and where we were headed as a planet. And so I think of those three moments as being the moments in which I received the most devastating news I've ever received. And so I do think a lot about the fact that we are very, very rapidly losing most of the ways that human beings communicate with one another and the way that we record and process the experience of being human and interacting with the non-human world or more than human world. And like nuclear war and climate change, I think of it as a tragedy that I can't even get my head around, much less put into words. And so when I am engaging with Irma Pineda's work and the work of other indigenous poets and thinking about bringing it into English, I really am very conscious of the tragedy that I am engaging with.
Karen, I want to see if I can take you a step further, something that Wendy was just saying, and that is that 50% of the languages in the world are endangered, and that is not talking about the languages that have already disappeared, about 6,000 languages. And there is often the statement that plants and animals are endangered. Roughly 7% of all the plants and all the animals in the planet are endangered. Climate change is directly connected with that. And people battle and march and protest and organize, and they make a big statement, as they should, as we all should, no doubt. But when we talk about endangered languages, people don't campaign in the same way. Thanks to you, we have those voices and those sounds. It is radio that is bringing them. But it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong here, I wonder what your views are on this, the people don't rally behind an endangered language. Maybe they activate their nostalgia button and feel, I don't want this language. And thanks to Karen and thanks to Wendy, we will listen to them. But languages will go faster as a result.
One of the things Wendy and I are doing in this piece is sharing this fantastic rallying for an indigenous language in this region, showing how one rallies and how this region is rallying with so much passion for its indigenous language. And I'm really thrilled that you brought up this whole issue of climate change, because I actually see indigenous languages and climate change connected, because there's a way of living in relationship. It's profound in so many indigenous cultures. That is what will help this planet survive. I personally need the unbelievable poetry and deep relationship of Zapotec. I have been fed by the way this language and this culture is in connection to human and non-human world. And it's a way of being in relationship to nature that we need if we're going to work with a lot of environmental catastrophes right now that humans and particular kinds of capitalism have created. And I think something like Standing Rock might not be explicitly about indigenous language, but it's about indigenous culture. And again, making really huge links between ways of being. And language is a form of a way of being. It's an expression of a way of being. It's not just a language that's abstract. It's a totally integrated relationship. And that, again, that these are extremely linked. We all need these languages and the wisdom that they have.
A language is the memory of its speakers. A language is the entire civilization of those that have lived with it. But at the same time, as a speaker of at least one endangered language, language that might not survive another 100 years, let me play the devil's advocate. Isn't it part of evolution? Not only progress, but evolution. Isn't part of the Darwinian struggle for survival that some languages die and other languages make it to the next round? I'm also often surprised by the fact that we will decry the disappearance of Aboriginal languages in Latin America or in Africa, and I myself come from Latin America, and I have been involved in the preservation of a few of these languages, but the arrival of a new language doesn't champion any cause. In fact, it is often seen as another threat. Here is a language that is going to displace English, or is going to displace Spanish, or is going to displace Chinese. Don't you think that the disappearance of language is also a natural phenomenon, in that we have beautiful poets like Irma Pineda, the way we have beautiful poets like Virgil, whose language, Latin, is no longer spoken? It survives in books, and that's part of human history.
Yeah, one of the things that Wendy and I worked to do in this, in You Will Not See Me Die, a radio documentary, is to put the language loss of Zapotec in the context of migration and economics. As Irma Pineda says in the piece, a lot of the natural resources in that region are not in the hands of the people living there, the indigenous people. They're in the hands of corporations, which is connected to this profound migration that happens in Mexico and, of course, globally. I really do see economics as choices. Again, different stories we tell about how we share our resources or don't. And economics, different assumptions we have about how we work together. So I would challenge your devil's advocate position by saying it's happening in economic and political contexts that I find very harmful, and would think that those are not inevitable, and would even see worth challenging.
Wendy, what do you think?
I think this is such an important set of questions. One of the things that I'm thinking is that it's not a natural process, as you put it, in terms of which languages are in danger of extinction and perhaps going to disappear in the next century. I'm wondering whether Yiddish would be in danger of extinction if there hadn't been pogroms and the Holocaust and all of these other human-made, and I don't know whether you can call that natural or not, devastating situations that led to the deaths of many, many, many Yiddish speakers. And I think it's very parallel with Zapotec and with other Aboriginal and Indigenous languages, that I can still go to the university where I teach and study Latin, even though I can't hear anyone living speaking it. And if I could also go to the university where I teach and study Yiddish and Zapotec and Southern Lushootseed, which is the language language that was spoken in this area where I live, in the Puget Sound region, maybe I wouldn't feel the same real deep emotional devastation about the potential loss of those languages. But that's not the case. And that is, of course, related to why there are particular languages that are being lost. And then I also really agree with what Karen's saying, that as we lose these languages and we lose ways of looking at the world and histories of how people have looked at the world and cosmologies, I think we're losing exactly the things that we need to get us through global climate change and these very desperate situations that we have created for ourselves through global capitalism.
I want to reach the last question for both of you. I appreciate enormously the thoughtfulness and the commitment and the beauty of your comments. Karen, young people don't often come to radio. Radio is an easier sell for people that have reached a certain age. Maybe that is as it should be. I don't think so. And I wonder, what would you say to the next generations of the Karens who are about to discover radio? What do we need to do at a time when democracy itself is under siege in order either to protect radio or to use it as a weapon to protect democracy?
Yeah, I have had the deep pleasure of teaching young people college age, 18 to 20, to do radio, and the work they are doing is stunning. Because of this real surge of podcast, a lot of interest, using it as a fictional and non-fictional kind of documentary and story, personal story form. I have hope that a lot of young people will come, especially more and more wonderful opportunities like here at NEPR even, and claiming the voice. I mean, I know on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, I turned on and listened to Pacifica Archive recordings of a speech that he gave in 1967 and was just like, oh, what a great, amazing feeling, the power of word broadcast, like literally the energy and what it does to my body, getting back to the body and the kind of inspiration and fire it gave me. And it made me think it would be so wonderful to do political speeches with young people on the radio and broadcast them, like, what do you have to say? And say it. And this amazing form where we get to speak beyond the realm of our body, it's just this incredible thing, this microphone and this broadcast, or even a narrowcast. I do narrowcast with my own personal transmitter sometimes too. And it's just amazing what we can do by the power of our own word. And democracy is totally a voice practice. It's a practice of learning how to speak and that art form, the poetics and politics of speaking. So radio is really a vehicle for that.
The beauty of radio is that it has that disembodied voice that can come across. You don't have to focus your attention on anything. Your eyes can wander, but your mind will be focused. Wendy, final thoughts?
I think that radio is a really important medium, not just for being able to let people in Australia and North America know about what's happening in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in the city of Juchitán, but also for folks in those communities to communicate with one another. For more than 20 years, I've been watching the growth of community radio in rural and indigenous communities in Mexico and also in several Central American countries. And one of the things that's really helping to keep some of these languages alive is community radio stations where elders can go in and broadcast in the language and offer basic language instruction to children who are listening at home, whose parents might not speak the language, but the grandparents do. And there's a huge amount of energy and joy going into this community broadcasting, you know, throughout Mexico and in other places. And I found that to be a huge inspiration in terms of a fairly simple technology that has a really huge democratizing potential.
Radio and democracy and language and the survival of cultures, it has been extraordinary to have both of you. And to have the voice, the sounds of Zapotec, Irmas, and the others invited here. I am so happy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was really delightful.
Languages evolve the way living creatures do. They are born, they mature, and they die. It's a natural cycle. But as in the case of living creatures, that cycle varies from one individual to another. Some die young, others have an extended life that defies expectations. The survival of a language cannot be done artificially. To be alive, a language needs to have a reason to exist. There must be a need for it. That need is often linked to technology, which entails the transmission of that language not only from one person to another, but from one group to the next. A painting of a mammoth on a cave wall is technology. Papyrus is technology. The Rosetta Stone, a scroll, a book, TV, an iPhone. My favorite technology is radio. It is soft, discreet, unobtrusive. If used ingeniously, it pushes us to think. It entices the imagination, and it makes us act. I can't think of a more democratic tool for technology. Radio is language, plain and simple. Sounds, words, silences. Without this, there is no radio. But sounds and words and silences need to be arranged in inventive ways to leave a mark, to deliver a message. We also need to recognize that alternative languages, what linguists called polyglossia, are essential to good radio. Young people use language in very different ways than adults do. The language of the city is different from that of the country. The language of ethnic groups is astonishingly distinct, as is the language of diverse genders. Radio makes those languages come alive. It keeps them in our attention. It offers those languages a shot at memory. In other words, radio has an impact on the survival and dissemination of languages because it allows language to travel far and wide. It fortifies languages, and it makes us nostalgic for ways that are no longer in use, that are on the way to oblivion. Radio matters. Next time on In Contrast.
Andropov and some of the other leaders saw Gorbachev as a kind of ideal product of communism, what they wanted communism to produce. The Soviets had a phrase for that, the new Soviet man.
William Taubman discusses his biography of Mikhail Gorbachev on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Segments of the radio documentary You Will Not See Me Die were used with the permission of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation series Earshot. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.